Hi, I'm David Schwartz, and I love writing books for kids about math and science, books that get children to think about their world, to wonder, and to find new ways of answering questions, new ways of looking at things. You're listening to Just One More Book.
Just one more book, please, sir.
What?
We're serious.
Serious what?
Just one more book, please. Please, come on over here, please.
Okay.
I got him.
We generally expect children's books to educate and entertain children. It's a special book that inspires a child to experiment and explore the world around them. What It Takes is an author that conducted experiments during their own childhood, experiments like measuring the length of a frog and the distance of its hop to figure out how far a human with frog legs could hop. It takes an author that's willing to count and pop 100,000 kernels of popcorn to demonstrate big numbers. Our guest on this edition of Just One More Book is David Schwartz, author of 50 books, including How Much is a Million, which inspired our two daughters to count to 500 during a walk prior to this interview, and Sybil's nonfiction finalist, Where in the Wild. This is episode 373 of Just One More Book. You obviously grew up extremely curious. Were you born that way?
Was I born curious? I can't say whether I was born curious, but many of my earliest memories have to do with satisfying my curiosity, or as I sometimes like to call it, my sense of wonder, of wondering things and trying to find out answers. And sometimes my parents encouraged me, and sometimes they were rather baffled by it, so that makes it a little bit difficult to know whether I was born that way or raised to be that way. I have one early memory, for example. Growing up in New York City, we would go to my grandmother's house for holiday dinners. And during dinner, I'd sit on the Brooklyn telephone directory, and that was, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pages thick, and it was my high seat. But after dinner, I took it to my grandmother's bedroom and sat on her rocking chair, and because I wondered how many pages were in the phone book, I decided to count them. Well, my mother, who was an English teacher, thought this was a very curious thing for her son to be doing. When she walked in one day, and there I was counting the pages of the phone book, she said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm counting the pages of the phone book." And she said, "Why are you doing that?" I said, "Well, I'm wondering how many there are. I want to find out." And she said, "Well, David, look, you don't have to count them to find out. You just have to read the number on the bottom of the last page." And she turned all the pages over and pointed to the number on the bottom of the last page. And I lifted my hands up to my eyes and covered my eyes. And I said, "No, no, no, don't ruin it for me. I want to find out myself." So here's an example of an early curiosity. Wasn't exactly encouraged by my parents, but in a way I had to persist despite them. But then there are other examples where they would bring me places, for example, a pond that was in the neighborhood of New York City where we lived in a small park, and they would ask me to see how many animals I could find. And I was at that time, and I was pretty young, loved looking at the dragonflies, but they were kind of scary. And I asked, you know, "Are these dangerous?" And they said, "Well, how could we find out?" My parents were great believers in reading, and so they would lead me to books where I could look up the answers to questions like that. Are dragonflies going to hurt me? I think they didn't really know the answer, but they knew that there were good ways to find answers to questions like that. And so I would, you know, delve into books and read about these animals that interested me. So I've been curious for a long time.
Do you think children these days still have that sense of curiosity?
That's a good question, really good question, and I wonder about it myself quite a bit. I do see a lot of evidence that leaves me a little bit worried that children are not as curious. They don't engage the real world in ways that I remember engaging the world. I remember just being out there doing things, looking at things, wondering about things, and so many kids, I think, they want to get answers only when the questions are required, say, of a, by a teacher. And because they're not out there really doing things, more engaging a virtual world or a video world, and sort of taking in information rather than raising questions, I'm a little concerned that kids may not be as curious. I have a friend who's a science teacher, sixth grade science teacher, or she was teaching sixth grade science a few years ago, and she asked her students to go home and find some around their house, find some organism that you could raise for a day, just long, keep it alive and happy, just long enough to bring it into school the next day, and then we would make some observations. They would make some observations the next day, and all they had to do was go find a snail or an insect or a worm or something and create a little habitat for it. And these kids lived in an area where that was going to be easy to do, but they found that to be a really hard assignment. They could have more easily gone and written 20 pages about Einstein than found a snail in the garden that's right outside their house. So that was a little note of disappointment for my friend who was the teacher and for me when she told me about it. That kids have a hard time doing something, is something like that.
I know that you're very committed to turning children on to math and science and encouraging experimenting and exploration. Of course, you do this through books and presentations. How are you able to connect with children to make them excited about being curious?
Well, I do it in those two ways, through books and through presentations. And what I do when I'm planning either my writing or my speaking is I kind of try to put myself back into my childhood self, which fortunately for me I think is still a big part of my adult self. And I think about what kinds of things I love to think about and wonder about and ways I like to approach the world back when I was a kid. And then I think about what's going to make that come alive. So just to give a couple of quick examples, this is another story that involves a pond and my childhood, but it was several years later, several years after the dragonfly example I gave before. I used to take my bicycle to a pond when I was in about fifth or sixth grade, a pond that was in my suburban neighborhood. Then we had moved from the city out to the suburbs of New York, and I would watch the frogs, and one day, as I was watching a frog, I was wondering how good of a hopper that frog was for its size. Compared to its own size, how far did it hop? Well, I measured the frog. I caught the frog. I measured it, found out that it was about 3 inches long. I let it take a hop, measured how far it could hop. It hopped about 5 feet or 60 inches. And I realized that the frog was hopping a distance that was 20 times its own size. And I thought, well, what if I could do that? What if I could hop 20 times my size? I figured out that meant I could hop about 90 feet, which would have been great when you play baseball. I could have made it into the major leagues if I could have hopped 90 feet. It would have gotten me from home plate to first base in just one hop. Well, years later, I was thinking about doing a book that involved ratios, and I realized that example was a great one. It led me to writing the book that is called If You Hop Like a Frog. And when I go to schools to do presentations, I pull out visuals. I pull out a rubber frog. I pull out a ruler. We measure the rubber frog. I tell this whole story. I show pictures on the screen of a hopping frog, and I act out the idea of being able to hop 20 times your own size. I have this cutout that represents me back then when I was 4 feet 6 inches tall, and we can kind of measure out 20 iterations of this 4 foot 6 inch little profile of myself, and see how far it goes, and then do the math and find that it goes 90 feet. So that's one way I think that kids connect to. It's visual. They can put themselves in my younger shoes from back when I was 10 years old or so doing this. I hope they can. They seem to. And then another thing I do is I've written a lot of books that have the word million, the number million, in the title. My very first book was How Much is a Million? And when I started going to schools to talk about that book and later talk about other books also that had to do with big numbers, I started to think, well, what can I do that will get kids to really picture what happens to numbers every time you put a zero after the number and make it 10 times bigger. And all of a sudden, an idea literally popped into my mind, and the idea was to pop a lot of popcorn and show the students bags full of popcorn where each bag was 10 times bigger than the one before. So we go from 1 to 10 to 100 to 1,000 to 10,000 to 100,000. And we get a lot out of this. I don't just pull out the bags, but we talk about them. We count by 1s to 10, count by 10s to 100, count by 100s to 1,000, and so forth. And I'm also writing the number in different ways, which depends on how old the kids are. Maybe I'm writing it using exponents for children in 5th grade, 6th grade, and so forth. But here, too, the visual connection to this popcorn and the suspense, how big is it going to get? How big can it go? Adds to the excitement. And once again, the underlying message has to do with numbers are amazing. They're useful, and they can be a lot of fun.
50 books later, are these techniques working? Are they engaging children? Are you seeing a transition from children who might be absorbed in their Wii's and Nintendo video games to children who are going to go out and grab a frog and measure it?
Well, I have to tell you, Mark, that I find it amazing. It never ceases to amaze me how excited children can get about something as simple and untechnological as bags of popcorn. It does engage them, and it gets them thinking, and it gets them cheering. And despite the fact that they might go home to their Nintendo or Game Boy or whatever it is that is the current high-tech game du jour, regardless of what they might be doing outside of my presentation, they really do seem to love it. And then I get letters that tell me that it was awesome, which might be spelled OSOM, but that doesn't matter. You know, they just really it gets them thinking, and it gets them to appreciate some of the kinds of things that they're learning in a more dry way, a drier way from their teachers.
Okay, we've been talking a lot about your mathematical books. There are other books, of course, which you've written, some of which take a science and humanities focus, the most recent being Where in the Wild, which you co-wrote with your wife, Yael Shai. That's a nature hide-and-seek book, which is a really creative idea. How did that book come about?
Well, actually, that Where in the Wild, my most recent book, which was just out in the fall of 2007, last fall, and it's gotten around. I've been really excited about the response it's gotten. Is a collaboration among three people: the photographer Dwight Kuhn, and my wife Yael Shai, and I, who wrote the text. And Dwight and I have been working together for years, and we did a series of science readers or science books for beginning readers called Look Once, Look Again. And these involve his fabulous close-up photographs. And we set up the book in such a way that you see a close-up of part of an animal, you read some text that hints about what the animal is but doesn't tell you, you turn the page, and then you see the whole animal. So that's a guessing game. And when these books came out, I realized what I already suspected, which was that kids love guessing games. They love to guess. And so seeing how well those books had appealed to children's innate curiosity and love of games, we later had the idea to do a book on camouflage and also set it up as a guessing format. So you see a photograph of a scene in which there is a camouflaged animal. And then, well, originally we were going to have you turn the page. We later came up with a somewhat more elegant solution of this fold-out page or gatefold page. You lift the flap, and you see the same photograph in which Dwight has lightened the background so that the hidden camouflaged animal now stands out. So that was the original idea for the book. And then I had this idea more or less to challenge myself to see if I could write poems instead of prose about these animals. And I knew that Yael, my wife, was a fine poet and lyricist. She likes to write songs and poems, and so I involved her in this project, and together we wrote a poem for each animal, and in a way similar to the Look Once books, it doesn't tell you what the animal is, but it gives you hints about it. And one thing that became apparent right away was that this book could have different kinds of poems. They weren't all going to be the same style for each animal. If we could do rhyming poems and non-rhyming poems. We could do very figurative metaphorical poems and others that are more literal. We could have different rhyming patterns, different meters, different lengths, different moods. And so that's what we tried to do and did do. We have 10 poems for 10 animals, and each one is really quite distinct from the other.
You've written a book called Super Grandpa about an elderly gentleman who sets out to do something he was told not to do, which was to participate in a 1,000-mile bicycle race. Presumably, he was told to do that for health reasons. Have you found any more superhuman stories that you're going to turn into children's books?
Well, ever since writing Super Grandpa, I've always been hunting around for a good story to turn into a Super Grandma counterpart. Super Grandpa, the book that I did write, is based on a true story that took place in Sweden in the 1950s. And I have my eyes and ears open listening for a story that I could tell about a woman of a similar age who does something similarly amazing and captures the public's attention and the public's imagination. And so that might be forthcoming.
What's your favorite children's book? Leave us a message on our voice feedback number, 206-350-6487, and we'll include it in the show. Be sure to drop by justonemorebook.com for our searchable archives of audio reviews and interviews. The theme song for Just One More Book is Woolly Mammoth by Robert Farrell. Thanks for listening, and please stay subscribed.